When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast. It's LiesOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and our friends at Madison Computer Works. Joining us now, the associate editor of the Capital Times and associate for The Nation, John Nichols. John, quite a week. I have never seen Tony Soprano in front of a joint session of Congress, but it actually happened this week.
The economic miracle is taking place in the United States, and the only thing that can stop it are foolish wars, politics, or ridiculous partisan investigations. If there is going to be peace and legislation, there cannot be war and investigation. It just doesn't work that way.
I think Tony might have been smarter than that. Tony would have done it behind the scenes in a nice, quiet way as they were walking out to their cars. What do you think?
Yeah, probably. Although, or he might have said, instead of it just doesn't work that way, maybe, you know, somebody might have a problem with that. I don't know how you say it, but
that was really stupid. That was a really stupid thing to say.
I think that if you're looking at this speech and you're going to like carve out stupid things to say, you know, there's going to be a few, right? Let's break that down just a little bit. There's several ways in which it's stupid. Number one, he created the clip for when he's impeached, right? Or for the rest of it. It's going to be that little clip's going to be there for a long time. I don't know if it's I'm not a crook one, but it's in the game. You know, it's in the category of like guys who are in a lot of trouble saying sort of bombastic things that will come back to haunt them. Number two, he took the presidency to a whole different place there. We've had presidents who've been in a lot of trouble before. Presidents have given State of the Union addresses while facing impeachment. Or at least the threat of impeachment. Presidents have done it, you know, at times of massive crisis, real challenges, and yet they've never done this. This is new. This is threatening, obviously, perhaps the Mueller inquiry, but also the chamber that you're dealing with, because obviously anything that comes from a Mueller inquiry is likely to circle back there, as well as the investigations that committees in the House, especially, have already launched. So that's your, you know, that's a, taking it to a new place, and you're basically saying to them, to the House, you mustn't do your constitutional duty to check and balance, provide oversight, because if you do, you cannot do your other constitutional duty, which is to govern, right? It is an unreasonable and bizarre demand. And then the third element, last thing, is it's a lie. Presidents in very difficult circumstances, including circumstances where they're in great conflict with the House and Senate, have governed. I know it's going to sound absurd, but remember Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton. As the Republicans in the House back in 2007 into 2008 were really gearing up, going after, I'm sorry, 1997, 1998, I apologize. But when they were really gearing up going after Bill Clinton, Clinton and Gingrich were still governing. You know, and then when Gingrich went out, others were governing. And I don't even like a lot of what Clinton
said. Is
that
about the time Speaker Gingrich was having sex on Steve Gunderson's desk with one of Gunderson's staffers? Is that about that time?
I don't know about that.
Oh. Okay.
But what I do know...
How's that for a mental picture?
What I do know is this, that you've almost...
I rendered you speechless.
Yeah, rendered you speechless, but what I do know is this, that Bill Clinton and the Republicans in Congress actually passed things, passed laws, functioned, I would argue, as well or better, you know, on moving legislation and that, then we're functioning now.
Listen to what you're saying. You're going, Oh, the Gingrich Clinton years. Those were the good old days.
They were horrible. And I can I go a step further?
I know, but
they
it's funny.
Things I really disapprove of.
Right.
You know, I mean, awful stuff. Okay. But my point is that when Trump says this, he's lying. He's literally telling the American people, boy, if there are inquiries, if there's investigations, everything will grind to a halt. That's one of the biggest lies about accountability. Things didn't grind to a halt when the Congress was going after Clinton. Things didn't grind to a halt when Nixon...
But didn't he grind things to a halt for the last 35 days? And isn't he threatening to do it again?
Well, yeah, that's what, it's where it takes it to a different place. But this is all on Trump.
I know.
And it's really a deeply...
Well, it shows you how unskilled he is as a politician or negotiator. If he thought that that was going to intimidate Adam Schiff, Jerry Nadler, or Elijah Cummings, it did not. Here's their response.
Well, I want to address the president's remarks last night, his effort to discourage any meaningful oversight of the administration. That's a non-starter. We are not going to be intimidated or threatened by the president.
We are doing what is demanded by our Constitution. That is to be a check and balance on the executive branch. As a matter of fact, we're sworn to do that, and we're going to do that.
But to say that we can't do that is to say we shouldn't do our constitutional duty. It's to assert an executive preeminence that one would think he might want to be a dictator. He cannot escape, nor should any president escape congressional oversight.
Now, they're not chairman of the Agriculture Committee or some subcommittee on postal reform. Adam Schiff, House Intelligence Committee. Elijah Cummings, House Oversight Committee. Jerry Nadler, House Judiciary Committee. Those are some big dogs.
But they are in fact the veteran members of Congress who have, in many senses, prepared for the roles they are in for generations. I mean, they have long experience. They've been in, you know, in Congress at different times with different presidents, different powers, and they speak from deep experience. And again, you said an interesting thing a moment ago about, you know, Trump, you know, kind of not getting the politics of this. And I think it's interesting because our media at this point has a hard time covering politics. It you know, Trump is so bombastic, so over the top, that people tend to, you know, tends to be a desire to have somebody come back at him just as hard, right? And they, you know, now they're trying to set up this Trump Pelosi thing and this, you know, kind of like back and forth between them and everything like that. But what you heard from those three members of the House, three senior members of the House with deep experience in the areas where they are working, is just this very calm research of the Constitution. And I don't know that we'll get to impeachment. I don't know if that's where this thing ends up. But what I will tell you is if you go back and you listen to the Watergate hearings and committee meetings and stuff like that, look at how calm and focused a Peter Rodino was. Look at how, you know, serious and thoughtful Sam Ervin was.
Bob Kastenmeier.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, yeah. Bob Kastenmeier. They did not light up a room, right? You know, but yet they remained very focused, very serious. Listen to Barbara Jordan's speech sitting on the Judiciary Committee talking about her duty to the Constitution, you know, her whole investment in the duties of her office. This is what's going to, if it gets to that point, this is what's going to take Donald Trump down. What? It's going to be the people who are his exact opposite, who are calm, who are focused, and who know what they are doing, proceed in the, you know, in a confidence in the Constitution.
All right, speaking of taking Trump down, here is Mike Pence on CBS.
the president referred to last night was partisan investigations. And, you know, you've spoken about the president. You know his feelings about investigations on Capitol Hill. We don't object to oversight. That's the proper role of committees in the Congress. But when it takes on a partisan tint, when it seems more intent on becoming a forum for invective against the president and against the administration, the American people expect better.
So that's an amazing projection, isn't it?
You know, it's always kind of sad, the guy who's got to clean up after the circus.
Yeah.
You know, just a tough guy. It's, you know, it's a real job. It's a legitimate job. You get paid to do it. But, you know, after everybody's done all the high wire acts and the elephants and everything that's been out there, you know, folks go home and then somebody's got to go sweep up.
Here is Donald Trump responding to the reaction to his State of the Union address.
This morning, the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, said that he was going to launch a deep investigation into not only Russia, but your
Adam Schiff?
He's just a political hack who's trying to build a name for himself, and I think that's fine because that's what they do. It's called presidential harassment.
President, you know, he really should not coin that phrase. Presidential harassment. That's not
But you're exactly right there. He's coining that phrase. He says it's called presidential harassment. Like he's pulling some phrase out of the law books here. Yeah, you know, that's a. I'm not sure everyone's aware of this, but there is a crime, presidential harassment, and that's what this is called. No, it's not. You just came up with it. You're like searching your head for something to say, and the fact of the matter is, if there was any harassment at all,
it was him.
It was his speech.
By the way, is Leah Vukmir or Mark Newman working for Donald Trump now? Because he was kind of getting into the edges of their vivid descriptions of late term abortion.
Yeah,
I'd never heard a president go there.
No, well, you know, he has gone there. So I heard him once do a speech a while back. You know, this is sort of something he's downloaded. But here's the interesting thing about
he was defending late-term abortion 5 years ago.
Oh, I know. I mean, when I say download, it's a recent download. But this is an interesting thing about that speech, and it's why that speech gave anybody who actually listened to the whole thing, and I'll acknowledge I did, whiplash. Right? It was whiplying back and forth. You know, he's up there and he's like, we can do great things. He has sort of this Reagan-esque opening about, you know, the bipartisan.
Yes, stylistically, he has improved using that teleprompter. He worked the room pretty well.
He opened with this sort of, you know, vivid expression. He's kind of very dishonest. You know, I just finished 35 days of shutdown. Now I know we can work together kind of thing. And so you get this, and then, you know, without acknowledging the shutdown, which he should have done, but without really acknowledging it, he talks about getting together, cooperating, stuff like this, and then suddenly he's repeating the exact language of the shutdown, right? His whole wall thing and all this, you know, awful assaults on immigrants, his imagery, his language, and so thus, you know, kind of knocking it back. He's talking about cooperation, working with Congress, and thus, and yet then he's back in there with this, you know, these investigations, stuff like this. And then, you know, trying to say, oh, well, we want to get beyond divisiveness and stuff like this. And he goes this whole rant on socialism, right? America's not going to be a socialist country. And what you have to understand here is, I think that Donald Trump currently lacks a center of gravity in the White House beyond himself. And so he's got different camps. And I actually think, now this is going to sound like a crazy thought, so just take it in. I think he's got one camp, which I will call the sane camp, in which Kellyanne Conway, of all people.
The leaker?
With Kellyanne Conway and some of those people, I think they are saying, you know what, when the shutdown ended and things calmed down, your poll numbers went up, Mr. President. So what you want to do is emphasize your ability to govern and stuff. And so I saw her in some TV appearances where she was saying, "Well, this is what he's going to talk about. It's going to be a healing, conciliatory, unifying speech." You know, I don't know if she used healing and conciliatory, but unifying speech. And then you've got the Stephen Miller camp, the hardcore ideologues. And the thing is, the president gave an almost hour and a half long speech, and I think they, it's almost as if they each wrote, you know, 20 paragraphs, right? And then they put it in a hat, and they shook it all up, and then you made that the speech. So you got, here's a conciliatory, unifying, then there's a, you know, American carnage, you know, here's a, we can work together, here's a, you're a bunch of socialists. And it made for a speech where the only thing anyone heard, this is his big platform speech at this moment, right? The only thing anyone heard was the investigations part.
We'll take a break. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SlysOffice.com.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson, we love guitars.
Welcome back to SliceOffice.com. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation with us. SliceOffice.com brought to you by Madison Teachers, also Madison Firefighters, Local 311, and of course, Madison Teamsters, Local 695. I would be remiss if I did not mention that the Milwaukee Police Department has lost its third officer in the last 8 months in the line of duty. An officer shot and killed the other day on the near south side of Milwaukee. Just horrific events. I'm really troubled by this. And I'm also troubled seeing these stories, John, and I don't want to get in a gun debate, but these stories where it looks like the Senate, the House is going to come up with a background check bill that 85% of Americans agree with. You know, people are getting their hands on guns through these loopholes, and it appears the Republicans are going to kill that in the Senate. This is something that could be done in such a, you know, I'm a strong defender of the Second Amendment. That's a no-brainer.
No, I have.
I mean, we should not have our officers dying on the streets because criminals have guns.
And also, this is something where you really could bring police chiefs and community activists and, you know, people from all across the spectrum together. I mean, you know, Trump could lead on this, but I don't think he will, and I don't think that Mitch McConnell will or others.
Ron Johnson.
And the tragedy of it is they won't vote, or they won't lead, not even because of general election politics anymore. The fact of the matter is that you had people running and winning elections last fall in battleground states and in you know, supposedly very competitive spaces as supporters of sensible gun regulations and rules. And so now it's really about Republican primaries.
In the suburbs of Atlanta.
Yeah. Oh, I know. Yeah. Running on and in fact, running very clearly and strongly on these issues, but also in the suburbs of Chicago and L.A. and, you know, places around the country. The fact of the matter is the needle has moved on this and has moved a long way. I actually think you will see it move even more in rural areas. In fact, I think it has to some extent. You know, look at an example of Sherrod Brown, who was reelected in Ohio. And carried a lot of places where Republicans usually win. I think you can be a supporter of sensible responses to gun violence, of abortion rights, of gay rights, and win in, you know, reasonably conservative areas if you also have a strong economic message and if you frankly, you know, just talk to people in common sense ways. So I think that now we've got a problem that's sort of retreated into the Republican primaries, retreated into these gerrymandered districts. And it, you know, it creates a dynamic in our politics. It's a really interesting one. And we had it back in, if you'll recall, like in 2006, when even sensible Republicans, I think it was, am I right that Lincoln Chafee went down in 2006?
Yeah.
So, Lincoln Chafee, a very responsible Republican in Rhode Island, running for re-election, saying, look, I've stood up to the Bush administration on war and a host of other issues, and a clearly very moderate guy, who Rhode Islanders liked. They went on to elect him their governor, and yet he got beat that year because the argument was you can't let the Republicans control a chamber of the Congress anymore because of what they do, what happens overall. And I think I genuinely think on some of these issues, gun issues and others, if the Republicans are just if they erect a wall, if they stop this.
Did you say erect a wall?
Erect a wall in Washington, not on the border. Good point. But if they stop this, they really feed the argument that, you know, folks just have to vote against any of them if they want to get even minimal progress on things.
All right.
It's a dynamic.
Let's go to Virginia.
First, it was the governor, then the lieutenant governor, now the state attorney general, the top three leaders in the state, all Democrats, all facing deep controversy. The latest is Attorney General Mark Herring, who admitted today that he once wore blackface at a college party. Ed O'Keefe has more on the chaos in the Commonwealth.
Virginia Democratic lawmakers were in no mood to discuss the latest scandal to rock Richmond. Attorney General Mark Herring admitting that he also once dressed in blackface. As an undergraduate in 1980, he said in a statement he and friends went to a party as rappers. We dressed up and put on wigs and brown makeup. He added, I have a glaring example from my past that I have thought about with deep regret in the many years since. When word reached the State House, there were audible gasps and expletives from staffers. Some lawmakers hung their heads in disbelief. And this from the head of the Virginia Legislative Black Caucus, Lamont Bagby.
Like I said, we're not praying enough.
The scandal rocketed all the way up to Washington.
I'm shocked and incredibly disappointed. This has been an awful week for Virginia.
Today's bombshell comes just days after Herring called for Governor Ralph Northam to resign over a racist photo, including a man in blackface, that was discovered on his medical school yearbook page.
I am not either of the people in that photo.
After that news conference, Herring had said it is no longer possible for the governor to lead Virginia. Northam remains out of sight as he contemplates his political future. He's meeting with black leaders and may hire a private investigator to prove it's not him in the photo. Then there's Lieutenant Governor Justin Fairfax, who's facing an allegation of sexual assault during the Democratic National Convention in 2004. Today, his accuser, Vanessa Tyson, put out a lengthy statement saying she's a Democrat and is sharing her story with tremendous anguish. She says she had gone to Fairfax's hotel room to retrieve documents and that after consensual kissing, Mr. Fairfax forced me to perform oral sex on him. Fairfax has repeatedly denied the allegation and responded today, saying, reading Dr. Tyson's account is painful. I have never done anything like what she suggests.
Okay, you know, it wasn't all that many years ago that Georgia elected Cooter to Congress. Ben Jones, who was on the Dukes of Hazzard. I don't even remember this happening to him, John.
Well, Georgia, with all due respect, elected Lester Maddox.
Yeah, but Ben Jones wasn't an overt racist. But, I mean, he was in the show The Dukes of Hazzard. You know.
No, what I'm saying is...
I know.
In your lifetime, Clyde, this
oh, horrible. I met Lester Maddox in underground Atlanta. Yes.
I bet you did. Well, and I was just thinking of him and Bill Dyke the other day.
Oh, that's right. They were a team for the American Party in 1976.
76.
Okay,
Virginia,
the Commonwealth.
Yes.
Well, someday we're going to have a discussion on why Kentucky, Massachusetts, and Virginia call themselves a Commonwealth versus a state.
Yeah, it's actually it's a wonderful thing, by the way, you know, the notion of Commonwealth. It is that, you know, it's a notion of governing. It's that you share... you know, some of your resources to create, you know, to do things together in a commonwealth.
Well, now it's chaos in the Commonwealth.
It sure is. and wow, what a mess. You know, I've followed Virginia politics for a very, very long time. And I can tell you that what's going on there is that in Virginia, they have a very odd system. You know, that you'd serve one term as governor, right?
Mm-hmm.
And or in these other you serve your term. And as a result, Senate there is an infrastructure built up politically. It's operated historically. It went from the old Byrd machine.
Harry Byrd, independent senator.
And his dad and everybody. And they were racists, important thing to understand, practiced massive resistance to desegregation, horrible people. And then that transferred into the Republican Party. And actually, literally, Byrd people sort of moved over into the Republican Party. You got Mills, Godwin, and people like that. And so you had this circumstance in Virginia for a very long time, sometimes broken, but rarely, where a certain Virginia elite, if you will, chooses somebody who then they kind of back through a primary and they make it up. The reason I tell that, or the reason I bring that background into it is that these people come up in, many of them, not all of them, but many of them come up in a political culture that is insular, right, that supports and sustains itself quite often. And I think that really what you're seeing with the governor there is somebody who's come out of that. And it's astounding to me that he didn't, you know, stand down, you know, when it came his way, when all this came at him. And of course, now if he had stood down, and we had this coming out with the lieutenant governor, you know,
well, maybe he knew that.
He may have. I don't know. There's talk of, you know, different people hearing different things and, you know, earlier knowing stuff. And again, the insular culture of Virginia politics and many different camps within it that you know, relate to and connect with one another.
Well, it wasn't all that long ago Ralph Northam was a Republican, right?
Well, that's what I'm saying. I'm really trying to emphasize that point, is that you know, you've got people who come out of communities, traditions, politically, that have historically crossed party lines. Now, that's not true with all the folks we're talking about here. Obviously, the lieutenant governor, a very young guy coming up, and really, in many ways, making a lot of his own way politically. But this is a challenge for Virginia now, because there's a lot of things that they ought to look at reforming. And I know it's a kind of ticket going up high on this rather than down into the weeds. They really need to rethink a lot of their systems and structures for how you go up politically in that state and how you open the processes up. To some extent, that has happened, but there's a lot that needs to happen in the short term. And the problem is, I can talk about the need for reform and opening up their processes and making changes. I can't talk about how they get out of this slide, because I don't know.
Well, it looks like through attrition, they're all going to just kind of survive.
Well, but in their positions, in this crisis.
Right. They will do great damage to their party, but how'd you like to be raising money for those legislative elections right now? How'd you like to try to be encouraging the African-American vote to turn out? Although, you know what's interesting? I saw reporters in Richmond interviewing a fair amount of African-Americans that were far more forgiving of Ralph Northam than politicians and people on TV. There is genuine affection for him.
There may be. And in fact, I'm of the view that Northam, really has handled this unbelievably horribly. And brought, you know, some of his own, because it's just a 10-year.
Well, this all started when he mishandled the terminology in talking about late-term abortion as well. He's had a couple faux pas.
No, and so I mean, maybe there's people who know him who are saying, yeah, he's not speaking well to the circumstance and blah, blah, blah. Here's what I would say. Virginia has a interesting situation where they've got a off-year election cycle. Their legislative seats are up, and they have elections this fall that are very important, actually, because of tightly divided legislature. And frankly, I wish that they could have new elections. And it's a pretty good argument for the 2-year terms. Why?
Well, we had that. So
a lot of states did.
You know, they like Wisconsin used to. They elect their lieutenant governor and governor separately.
Which is good. I like that.
Had there been a Republican lieutenant governor, what would have happened when the Ralph Northam story came out? Would there have been so many Democrats jumping all over it?
I think the national folks, yeah. I mean, for good reasons and appropriate reasons. I think in Virginia...
I'm not so sure.
Maybe. You may be right. I think some of the national folks might have. But I'm sure Kirsten Gillibrand might have.
The worst presidential candidate ever?
No.
Okay, Amy Klobuchar is getting in the race this weekend. She'll be the worst candidate
ever.
Oh,
I can name worse. Come on. In fact,
Wilbur Mills.
I'm not even sure Joe Biden, with all due respect.
Oh, he's a terrible candidate.
You know,
and he will be again.
There's a little history there.
All right, before we go.
Yes.
Let me play this clip, because things weren't crazy enough with chaos in the Commonwealth.
Democratic presidential hopeful Elizabeth Warren is facing new backlash tonight over her claims of Native American ancestry. The senator from Massachusetts apologized today after a decades-old document surfaced that shows Warren declared herself to be an American Indian. Nancy Cordes has more on this.
I'm not a tribal citizen, and I should have been more mindful of the distinction.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren apologized today for listing American Indian as her race after being accepted to the Texas Bar Association in 1986.
This is who I grew up believing with my brothers. This is our family story, but family stories are not the same as tribal citizenship, and this is why I have apologized.
Warren launched a presidential exploratory committee in December.
I'm in this fight all the way.
So there's chaos in another Commonwealth. Did she really? I mean, here they listed, you know, race, and she put American Indian. I understand thinking that you have some ancestry. I'm about an eighth Irish, but I wouldn't put Irish down on some application, or I wouldn't put, if I thought I was maybe, 1/20th or 1/5th American Indian, I wouldn't write that down as my race. What is she thinking?
Yeah, I mean, then there is the overlay that because of centuries of, you know, horrible policies, we do have some additional protections and sometimes some opportunities for people who have suffered historic discrimination. So when you put that label on, you're not merely, stating identity. You're also potentially, and people look at it with a concern, potentially seeking to get an advantage, right? Some advantage. And I don't know that that's what Elizabeth Warren did. What I do know...
Well, she wrote it down on the card.
I don't know what her motivation is.
Oh, okay. Well, I don't know what her... It doesn't make any sense to me. But ironically, our racist president calling her Pocahontas, and he's got the picture of Andrew Jackson up in the Oval Office. Ironically, the racist seems to have gotten the better of someone who used poor judgment or was unmindful of what's appropriate to put down for your race. It is remarkable that Donald Trump, in the midst of all this chaos in Virginia and all the chaos in with Elizabeth Warren, just keeps moving along.
Well, I mean, he has had chaos around him forever and survived. And maybe that sets a model that others will emulate. But look, here's the challenge with Elizabeth Warren. I know that this is a big challenge for her, because not merely because of the facts that come forward, but also because, as you heard her there, she struggles to explain. You know, her explanation is credible and understand. You know, she's saying what she's saying, and that's that. You know, it's not credible that everybody hears it, but you know, she states it, and that's, I give her due. But it doesn't sound great. It sounds like wrestling with it, struggling, and that's not coming from a place of strength when you're running for president of the United States. And the interesting thing is that her biggest challenges, she kind of jumped into this race after with some missteps and some concerns about how she's handled some of these issues. And other people are also in the race who are frankly just getting more attention. And I think of Senator Harris. I think of this, the incredible focus and fascination on non-candidate at this point, Beto O'Rourke. The end result is that I think Warren's kind of getting boxed in here as somebody who a lot of people had a lot of sympathy for, who frankly really liked. But it doesn't look to me like her campaign is hitting its mark. And things like this really become burdens.
These are interesting times, my friend. John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, five more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.